welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We had to cut through to another world and find a new library full of books we hadn't read yet, because we'd read all the books, so we had to take a break.
That's right. It was worth the cost of two of my fingers. But I'm a little concerned, because they're still bleeding.
Yeah, Ben might pass out during the podcast.
It's okay. If I do, you'll still be able to hear from Gabs. She's the one you're tuning in for anyway, I'm
sure. So this week we read The Subtle Knife by Philip Pullman.
The second book in the Golden Compass trilogy.
Yeah, called His Dark Materials.
Yes, kind of like the, kind of like how Game of Thrones is Song of Ice and Fire, but no one calls it that.
Yeah, everyone always refers to series by the name of the first book, and you can't really get away from it, so.
Right.
Golden Compass Trilogy.
It makes me wonder if this book was originally titled His Dark Materials, and the publisher wouldn't go for it. And he's like, damn it, but that's the name of the trilogy. No one's going to call it that now.
Like, that's too dark for a kid's book. Let's move on.
Oh, sounds kind of like it's from a video game to me. Like, it'd be fine for kids.
Well, I don't know. This way it works because the first, second, and third book are all the name of an object that's right. Important to the book. So it's actually more cohesive that way.
His Dark Materials 2.
Maybe His Dark Materials
his darker
is just
materials.
A shitty name for a trilogy, Philip Pullman.
Yeah, maybe.
Think about that. We'll go ahead and act a spoiler policy, which we are on and off good about doing. The book came out a while ago, but just because, these books contain some pretty cool revelations, if you don't want to be spoiled and would like to read it first, then you should turn off the podcast.
Yeah, and maybe go pick up the first book.
Yeah, probably the Golden Compass. Then you listen to that podcast.
Yeah, there you go.
Then read The Subtle Knife.
Hey, if you're a big enough fan to actually take our suggestions in the first place, then that seems plausible.
Well, yeah, I mean, depending on how many of the books our episodes are about that you've actually read. This
right.
This is one of the ones that I would heartily recommend, reading The Golden Compass. So.
And speaking of people who actually like us, thank you to Adam and Amy for the Twitter love.
Yeah. Wait, at least two people still listen to our podcast.
That's right. It's nice to know there are a minimum of two people who listened to our year in review and didn't think we were so far up our own asses that...
that they ran away.
Yeah, exactly.
Hooray!
Yay! We are reading, or I should say we read, this book because we did the Golden Compass last year.
I'm about halfway through.
The year before, even.
Yeah, that's right.
The reason we are reading this. So that spoiler alert was actually Gabs giving it to herself.
Yeah, I can't be talking about this right now.
Yeah, you're going to have to leave but when I start talking about who dies at the end. So I look forward to that. Yeah, basically we just thought it was about time that we moved to the second book in the series.
Yeah, we did Catching Fire fairly recently and thought it was time for another sequel so we don't leave people hanging.
That's right. Unless you're looking for the 50 Shades sequel, in which case, hang.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's never going to happen. Ben's pretty dead set against it.
If it was 300 pages of pain, I would do it for you guys. At, like, $5.50, I don't think I can make it.
What if we raised $50?
Oh, no.
For the 50 Shades of Grey sequel.
$50, that might buy me enough alcohol to get through it.
Challenge accepted. I mean, I don't have $50 to give you, but... I don't know if our two readers have $50.
That's right.
Our two listeners...
I'll tell you what, you figure out a way to send us $50, I will drunk tweet my way through this second 50 Shades book.
I have to apologize for my cough. I have a cough.
Yes. If I'm unable to edit all of them out, which is likely, that's a thing. So the
genre
is YA fantasy.
Yeah, it's actually Western now. Don't really know when that happened.
Well, there is a Texan.
From the country of Texas.
That's right. Stambling around a small town, dealing with the cattle rustlers and the expansion of the frontier and all the scary new changes in everyday life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's totally what this is.
No, it's still YA fantasy.
Yeah. the plot synopsis. Dark matter is conscious, idiot.
Obviously. There's a line Ben really liked where character asked, so dark matter is conscious? And dark matter actually replied, evidently.
Yes.
Ben was reminded by me saying, obviously.
That's totally what I thought of.
Come on. Yeah, we get to learn more about dust or dark matter in this book, and one of the things we learn is that it is apparently conscious, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, we still don't know what dust actually is, but we know it thinks.
Yep.
And it might help us think.
Maybe.
Seems plausible.
Matter is drawn to other matter.
Something. Or like that.
Something. We are not quite sure. So, this book is a little different because it starts out not with Lyra, who we followed around pretty much the entirety of the last book, but Will Perry. A shocking enough change that if you had never read the trilogy before, you might start book two and go, am I reading the right book? Because I definitely did that the first time I read this book. but we start by following around the character Will Perry, who is in our world, so no demons or magic, witches, or anything crazy like that, and he, is looking for his father, who was an explorer, who disappeared, and these mysterious men are questioning his mother about it, and he thinks his family's in danger, so he thinks, okay, I have to go find my dad. He manages to wander into another world where he meets Lyra, and they're both not in their own world, they're in another third world, so we know there are at least three of them. And the two of them meet and become friends and start looking around for his dad while Lyra looks for more information on dust. Will becomes the possessor of the subtle knife, which is a tool that can actually cut windows in the air into other worlds, so we learn that there are definitely more than three, and it turns out that there are multiple people looking for him, including Stanislaw Grumman, or Jopari, who's this shaman, because they want to take the knife to Lord Asriel, who is trying to wage war against God, basically. Yeah, that's about it. And he finds out at the very end of the book that Stanislaw Grumman is actually his father, and then his father immediately gets killed.
Yes.
It's pretty...
Before they can exchange a single word about it.
A rude awakening, because all of their exchanges are happening in the dark, and then finally, like, some kind of light, like the moon comes out or something, and they finally see each other and go, oh, shit, like, we found each other, and then he dies. It's like, oh, come on.
It's rude. The story takes place, the setting of it is in three different worlds. Lyra's world from the first book, our world that we are familiar with, and then this third one that seems to be kind of like a way station between worlds is Sitigaze, or Sitigaz, or Sigaz, or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Vaguely Italian-ish.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's kind of a Mediterranean-ish place as well,
yeah,
as far as the climate and the vegetation and all that good stuff. So it's, I guess, one more, but the point of view, past tense, following multiple characters, usually third person, pretty close.
So as opposed to the first book where you were basically just following Lyra around the entire time and her adventures and thoughts, in this book you get a good dose of Will's perspective, you do get Lyra's perspective, And then you get to follow Serafina Patella around a little bit, and you get to follow around Lee Scoresby. And those are the main four in this book.
Yeah. And that leads to a little bit of a, maybe our first debate here, but who is the protagonist of this book? Is it Will or is it Lyra?
Yeah, Lyra was definitely the protagonist of the first book, unquestionably. But this book starts with Will, and although you do get some of Lyra's point of view, Will's kind of leading the charge on a lot of different things, and a lot of it's dealing with his struggle trying to find his dad, thinking about his mom, and then becoming, like, the official owner of the subtle knife. Will is going through a lot in this book, and Lyra's there for all of it, but she's not experiencing quite as much. She's learning about dust and dark matter and what that's actually all about.
And this, what seems to be a gigantic war in heaven, more or less, that is shaping up. She is, in some way, the linchpin of events.
Yeah.
I,
or the, she doesn't really know that, and a lot right. of other people aren't sure how right. yet.
So, I mean, she's more like, almost more the main plot point than the main character.
Yeah.
in some ways. And I guess you could say, out of the first two-thirds of the trilogy, she's probably still the protagonist. But for this book, it feels more like it's Will to me.
That's true. If you took, like, total page count, since she dominates the first book so thoroughly, she would still overall be the protagonist. But it also feels like Will is the protagonist in this particular book, just because he is learning and growing and exploring and doing so much. And Lyra is by no means, you know, complacent or just sitting around or anything, but
no,
she's not...
Well, I don't think she could, anyway.
Yeah, she's she's not quite maybe growing quite as much as Will, because she doesn't have quite as many personal, like, revelations that happen in this book.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me.
So that'd be my argument.
So, why don't we go into some details about Will here?
Yeah.
He is a...
About 12?
Yeah, so he's 12. He's about her age. Gab's described him as street smart to the max.
He is street smart to the max. This kid, his mother has some kind of problem. And we don't know exactly what it is, but it sounds like some kind of mental illness that kind of comes and goes, and when she's sick, she basically can't function. And so Will has learned how to do all of these tasks from her so that he can take care of her and protect her, and, you know, like, his big goal is to make sure no one in authority ever finds out what's going on, because the worst thing that could possibly happen would be he gets separated from his mother. So he knows how to, you know, cook, clean, shop, like, take care of her, deal with money, and all this. And then even beyond just that stuff, once these guys come and start harassing her, he is proves to be really capable at, you know, getting this item away from them, and does a pretty good job of keeping himself hidden, staying out of the notice of others, knowing where's a good place to go to hide, what's not a good way to hide, stuff like that.
Yeah, he's good at blending in. That's how he thinks of it, at least. That's really kind of what motivated him to take care of his mother, as he knew if authorities found out what her condition was, that the two of them would be separated. So he's good at blending in. But he's also, I guess that also may be another word to describe him. He's kind of a protector type. And he's at his... He's at his most hardcore, he's at his most, like, forceful and stubborn when he does have something he's protecting.
And he kills a guy when he's protecting his mother.
Right, yeah. And he doesn't feel great about that, but he would probably do it again if he had to.
Mm-hmm. He, to be fair, did not originally intend to kill a guy. It was kind of a freak accident, but...
But he is, you know, if he's working towards a goal, if he is, again, especially if he's defending someone, then he'll kill you along the way with, if he has to.
It's true. And kind of by virtue of having to had, of being so street smart and growing up so fast, he's really serious. He's pretty much lonely, doesn't really have any friends. So he's not very, like, trusting of others. He's pretty suspicious of people, because he hasn't had really very good experiences in the past.
Right, and so that makes it, a little bit difficult for he and Lyra to trust each other initially.
Mm-hmm.
Though they overcome that eventually, which probably... shouldn't be surprising, because Lyra seems to have a gift for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the fact that it took him more than immediately upon meeting her to trust her shows you how suspicious he is, probably.
Because everyone else just was like, oh, hey, Lyra. Oh, I love you.
Right.
And Will's like, yeah, no, for at least a couple of days.
Well, yeah, and, I mean, for example, when Lyra goes and finds her a particle physicist. She walks into this office and meets Mary Malone, our next character we'll talk about here, and she immediately, and not even sure why she's doing it, just starts spilling her guts to this 12-year-old kid.
Yeah, Lyra's like, so, can you tell me about dust? And they figure out, oh, dark matter. And then she just kind of starts telling her about it in the experiment, and she's like, why am I telling you this?
That's right.
Lyra's like, you got to!
Yeah, because you have no choice. It's like, oh, well, we have this fancy electronic technological version of your cool steampunk gadget.
Yeah. Of the alethiometer. Yes. Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, that's another thing about Lyra and Will, is they're both resourceful and forceful. So, like, when they want something, the way, like, both of them do it pretty often is just by kind of figuring out a way where they can, like, demand it, you know?
True.
Like, okay, I have to do this now, so give me that.
Right. Why ask for something when you can just command them to hand it to you?
Yeah. And that's, I mean, Lyra's not completely like that. When she visits Mary Malone, she basically makes that argument, like, you have to tell me about this.
Right.
And Mary's like, oh, well, okay.
Well, maybe I do. Or, hey, I have nothing to lose.
Yeah. So Mary Malone herself, she's a particle physicist, although she used to be a nun, which is
interesting.
Yeah, you don't often find... Well, I wouldn't think you often find nuns who leave and become physicists.
I can't say that I've met very many physicists or ex-nuns.
Yeah, first of all, I don't know if I've ever just met someone who used to be a nun, let alone, like, an ex-nun who is now a physicist.
Right. And Mary is maybe a little less confident than Lyra, though that's not necessarily the same thing as saying unsure of herself.
Yeah.
But she's also very smart and resourceful.
Yeah.
And when she finds out from the dust that she and Lyra are connected and she has to make her way to the other world, she figures out how to make that happen.
And she goes and does it.
And she does it, yeah, exactly. And she bluffs her way through the security checkpoint, so...
A couple times,
That's pretty good.
She writes a program that gets the matter to go from, like, visual pictures to words. Because Lyra says, oh, this says if you wanted to make it do words, you can. And then Mary, like, manages to write a program to do that, which... It's just kind of, like, briefly mentioned, but which I think is really impressive. Like, computer programming, okay. And then the other thing is, like, I think that... Because when Lyra comes in with all this, her information about dust and what's going on, you know, she's asking, is it good or is it evil? And Mary keeps saying, like, do you know how crazy this sounds, like, in a scientific lab to be talking about something good or evil? But I think the fact that she used to be a nun kind of helps prime her for more philosophical or ethical questions.
Yeah, maybe that's the reason she didn't accept any of it to begin with.
Because if she was just, like, a cold, hard scientist from the beginning, she'd be like, what are you talking about?
Though she also says that if she hadn't been utterly exhausted when Lyra walked in, she may not have listened to any of it anyway.
Yeah, their program's about to die, and she hasn't slept in, like, 3 days, so she's just kind of like, oh, God. Yeah, whatever, I'll tell you.
And so, I guess, moving along to... Stanislaw Grumman / Joe Parry / John Parry, Will's father, as it turns out.
You find that out, like, what, 3/4 of the way through the book or something?
Something like that.
Like, why do people keep calling you Joe Parry? And he's like, oh, it's actually, like, my name, John Parry. Right. And then you're like, oh, shit!
Oh. So, yeah, he's an explorer / physicist / shaman. Kind of... managed to wander through a window into a parallel universe.
And couldn't find his way back.
Yeah.
Apparently it was in the Arctic and during a blizzard, so by the time they, like, even... By the time the blizzard stopped, they're like, oh shit, we're in a different world. And then he could not find his way back.
Right.
So he's been stuck in Lyra's world, essentially, for about 10 or 11 years.
Yeah, since Will was a babby.
A babby. A wee babby.
And he's in kind of an interesting blend of mystical and practical.
Yeah.
It's like that explorer side of him. Well, also, he has... though he's an explorer, he's also a former Royal Marine, and it seems like he may have had some intelligence type of connections, too. So he's a guy who... was kind of complex and knew a lot of things that were going on in the background in the world, and kind of had an idea of, I mean, he knew he was even possibly looking for a window into another world.
Yeah.
He just wasn't prepared. He just wasn't prepared when he actually wandered through one, I suppose.
Yeah, I bet if he would have been able to go through when the weather was good, he probably would have been more careful about marking where it was.
Right. And then when Lee Scoresby, our Texan pal from the first book, finds him, he is very shamanistic. Hey, I know thing. Hey, I called you here. Oh, well, how'd you do that? With your mother's ring. How'd you get that? I'm a shaman.
Yeah, basically.
Oh, okay.
I haven't seen that ring in 20 years. How'd you get that? I'm a shaman, you know. You know how it goes.
Right. I guess we're going to get there by balloon. We're going to have to wait for a favorable wind. He's like, I'll take care of that.
I'll give you the wind you need.
All right.
And then he takes down, like, 3 Zeppelins with magic, via magic.
Right.
The best one is when he summons, like, hundreds of birds.
I enjoyed that one, too.
To sit on the Zeppelin and make it crash. But, yeah, so he, like, does this crazy shaman crap. And then they're, like, trying to build a fire in a storm, and he's like, oh, I used to be a Boy Scout. I always carry matches with me. And you're like, oh, John Parry. You're an interesting mix.
Yes.
Oh, the other thing I liked about him is he was explaining, like, when he got to the other world, and he's like, okay, I have to, like, you know, get myself some sort of status here. Oh, well, like, I know enough to write a scientific paper. And so he just, like, gets into their, like, big, prestigious, like, scientific society and makes a name for himself straight off the bat.
Right. Touch on a couple of the characters from the first book. Learned a little bit more about Lee Scoresby, who sees Lyra kind of as his daughter, and, well, ends up dying in service of the cause, I suppose.
He's looking for Stanislaw Grumman because he heard that he had, like, knowledge or an object or something that could help protect Lyra, or that Lyra could have, or that he wanted to make sure.
Yeah, and it was important enough to him that she be protected that he was willing to give his life for it.
Mm-hmm.
Though if he'd remembered, he'd been able to call in witch backup a little bit sooner.
Yeah, he probably would have been.
He might have been okay.
Yeah, so... and it turns out this thing that Stanislaw Grumman's looking for is the subtle knife, which his son just so happened to become the bearer of. And it also just so happens that he and Lyra are friends, so Lyra's already under the protection of it. So all the stuff the adults are doing is kind of already happening.
Arguably unnecessary.
And everyone seems very determined, who's on Lord Asriel's side, seems very determined to get Will and the knife to Lord Asriel, because one of its nicknames, which I could not even dream of pronouncing, Ashath or whatever, is also translated roughly to, like, the God Killer. So it's some kind of weapon which could kill God and help Lord Asriel win this war against the Authority. So you can see why super religious people might not take that very, very kindly.
It's true. You can see why both sides of this war that's shaping up would also be eager to get their hands on such a thing.
Yeah.
And then we see Mrs. Coulter again, and she's even scarier than she was in the first book.
Yeah, when she was cutting little children apart from their demons, which is pretty bad. In this book, she is torturing witches. She's just breaking this woman's fingers with her bare hands. That's pretty horrific.
There are these creepy specters that eat your consciousness and turn you into an automaton.
Yeah.
And she can command them because apparently she's even scarier than they are, so they just do what she says.
The specters are like these weird shapeless mist forms that feed on your consciousness. And somehow Mrs. Coulter is able to tell them that, or they're able to understand that if they follow her around, she'll lead them to a lot of great meals, and so they shouldn't feed on her consciousness. And then at the end of the book, she somehow, it's very vague, but she somehow makes the specters forget that they are earthbound so they can fucking fly. Which, I mean, if you are an adult and being chased by these weird consciousness-eating things that you can't fight or attack or get away from, you would at least be like, oh, at least I can fly, but no, now they can fucking fly, so.
Yeah, so she takes out the witches who essentially had set up a combat air patrol.
Yep. The entire clan of witches that were helping Will and Lyra out, with the exception of Seraphina Pikella, who goes away at the last minute.
Yeah.
All the other witches get specter-eaten and die, basically. So that was pretty gruesome. And yeah, Mrs. Coulter is scary enough that she's in charge of that shit, so.
Yeah.
Her monkey demon continues to be horrifying and everyone hates it.
It sounds like it's just really creepy and disturbing.
Yeah,
and it acts in ways that most people's demons don't act.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. You know, it's this golden, shining, beautiful monkey. Which makes sense, because Mrs. Coulter is apparently, ridiculously beautiful.
Right.
But yeah, I don't think we actually ever hear it talk. Because usually you hear people's demons talking to them.
True.
And it just seems to act like a bitch-ass monkey. It
gives people evil looks and gets into things.
Swipes at him, tries to bite him and stuff. Just a mean-ass monkey.
That's right. So some of the issues in this book, it's setting up this overarching plot of trying to, kill the Authority, which is basically God.
Yeah.
Which is in turn supported by the Church.
The Authority is supported by the Church.
Right,
the war against.
Right.
The Authority.
And so you could, I suppose, argue how much of that is an anti-religion message and how much of that is maybe just an maybe more of a message against authority and corruption.
Yeah, so, Lord Asriel at the end of book one was saying that didn't he say, death was going to die?
Something like that.
You can view the Authority as kind of this oppressor figure. One of the witches gives this speech about why she thinks the witches should join the fight against the Church. She talks, cites the Bullvanger incident from the first book where they're cutting kids and their demons apart, but then is also just talking about the practice of, you know, cutting kids' genitals in general to try and keep them from being sinful, basically, and is saying, you know, the church is basically hurting people and trying to get rid of their ability to have feelings, and I think that's a bad thing, because one of the things witches really value is feeling and communing with the world. So that doesn't sound so much like a religion is bad, but religion that is, like, doing fucked up surgery on people is bad kind of thing.
Yeah, and the church in the book seems to be a version of an extension, maybe even. Maybe they never had a reformation in Lyra's universe. And so it seems to be a, like, medieval version of the Catholic
Church. Yeah, almost like Catholic Church at the height of its powers and...
The height of its powers and corruption.
Yeah, in, you know, 14th century Europe kind of thing. Which most people agree was not a good thing. Which is something I think it's important to consider when you look at these books, because I think as a churchgoer, it would be easy to be like, okay, like, this character wants to kill God, and he's not the bad guy. Like, most of the characters were supposed to, like, want to join him in this fight, so this book is anti-religion. But you can't just say, like, Lord Asriel just for kicks is like, I'm gonna kill God. Like, he has some kind of motivation, and the church is portrayed as pretty corrupt in ways that I think most people would agree is corrupt.
Right. We see them doing immoral things. Mm-hmm. We see them, we see them not only doing weird experiments on children, but for that matter, just raising armies and putting areas under pretty severe control, and it's not the sort of thing you usually think of happening from a benevolent authority.
Yeah. Although you could argue it's not necessarily the authority's fault, and maybe the church is getting it wrong.
Yeah, also possible.
But that's the thing, is we don't actually know if Lord Asriel is a good guy or a bad guy.
Yeah, there's a lot of moral ambiguity in, well, really, the series, both books so far. One of the things we really talked about a lot with the first book was that Lyra, as the protagonist, is really amoral. Not immoral, just amoral.
Right, she cares about some people, but she has no compunctions about, like, lying or stealing if she needs to.
Right.
You still like her, even though she does some of these bad things.
And Asriel is clearly the bad guy at the end of the first book, and now many of the characters we've come to think of as the good guys are flocking to his cause here in the second one.
Yeah, saying, you need to go support Lord Asriel, and, you know, like, John Perry, Will's dad, is this really wise shaman figure, and you think, like, oh, he's Will's dad, he's probably a good guy, and then he wants to take the knife to Lord Asriel, thinks it's all important. So, like, he can't be all bad, maybe. But it's the same thing where, at the end of book one, when Lyra and Pantalaimon were talking about it, and they're like, well, all the adults think dust is bad, so maybe it's good. Kind of thing, like, well, maybe what all the adults think is, like, not right. So we still don't really know.
Right. Maybe there is no good versus bad battle being set up here in the first place. Maybe it's all kind of morally ambiguous. And it's less about who's right and who's wrong and more about who has the power in this moment and what are they doing with it, and, you know, maybe the people who displace that aren't necessarily going about it in a good way, or maybe they're not necessarily going to do good things with it once they have it.
Okay, I'm going to make a comparison.
All right, here we go.
Hunger Games. We haven't read the third book for the podcast yet.
Right, so though we have both read it not for the podcast.
Be careful for spoilers, anyone who has not read Mahinje. District 13 versus the Capitol, you originally think is good versus bad, but then you find out District 13's pretty morally corrupt, and even though they're displacing an oppressive society, it kind of looks they're gonna like they're going to replace it with another oppressive society, and that it's not necessarily going about it the right way.
Right. It's not better, it's just different.
Yeah.
Or maybe the Game of Thrones universe, where it almost doesn't matter who you're talking about. Whoever has power just wants to have the power and isn't necessarily going to do anything for anybody.
Different people fighting for the throne.
Exactly.
Except for maybe one of them, but they get killed off.
Well, yeah, there you go. There's some, like, Roman emperor shit going on there.
Yeah, for sure.
Jockeying for position just to have absolute power for, you know, the 2 or 3 years before you get assassinated.
Yeah.
And the next guy takes over and does whatever the hell he feels like.
Yeah.
Until he, in turn, is assassinated.
Yeah, it is kind of amazing in retrospect. The Roman Empire survived past that phase. Not that this book has anything to do with that.
Well, you know.
All this stuff's kind of related to this battle where...
I almost can't have a conversation longer than 20 minutes without mentioning the Roman Empire at some point.
Just a disease
thing. Yeah, that's right. It's just a thing that happens.
I try not to compare, like, a lot of YA books to each other because I think it's really unfair when that happens.
Well, it kind of
in
fits...
in media, but I think in this case it works.
I was going to say, it almost fits into our love of terrible ad copy.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what that is. It's like, well, you liked this, so you should like this. I mean, it's a little different than saying, well, this is kind of similar to this, but, I mean, if you're going to get too deep into that, you know, Divergent is certainly marketed as the next Hunger Games.
Totally.
Right. And for that matter, and when I describe it to people, I like, oh, it's like the Hunger Games, except not like the Hunger Games and not good. So that's kind of unfair, too.
Yeah. But that situation is the same with this setup of jockeying for authority, and you're not really sure who's on the right side or who's on the wrong side. Although, in the case of the Hunger Games, you definitely know who's on the wrong side. But in the case of this book, The Subtle Knife, we're like, well, we definitely don't like what the church is doing, but that doesn't necessarily mean we don't like what God, the authority, is doing. We don't really know anything about the authority yet.
Yeah, you could argue there's the authority's side, the church's side, Lord Asriel's side, and Lyra's side, really.
And that's kind of what the characters we really like Lee Scoresby or Serafina Pakella, end up concluding is not that they're on the side of the church or Lord Asriel, but that they're on Lyra's side.
Right.
Her side first, and then whatever side that happens to be on, they'll go with that.
Right. And as long as they're operating in gray areas, the knife itself...
Yes.
...could actually kind of be representative of that as well, because the scholars who were able to make were on one hand on the cutting edge of human knowledge and...
Cutting edge.
Hey, look what I did. And ability. And built this thing that can affect, I guess, the very fabric of the universe. And may have, in doing so, brought the specters into their world and thus wiped it out.
Yeah. The world with the subtle knife and with Sitigaz is really interesting for the fact that they, at their height, seem to kind of be, like, Renaissance splendor, like what you imagine is, like, the height of Italy's splendor, you know, in our own Renaissance, but with a little more technology than that, because they actually have, like, soda machines and stuff, stuff.
They have refrigerators and Coca-Cola.
Yeah, they're not, like, a... Yeah, it's not exactly the same, but it's kind of that parallel. And then, yeah, they just take it a step too far and end up basically causing their own ruin. So was the creation of the knife a good thing? Because it's this great intellectual pursuit. You can cut through to other universes, which is fucking awesome. Or is it a bad thing because it was just kind of hubris and stretching too far, and didn't introduce the specters, and in the hands of the wrong person, it could definitely be a tool for evil. Although it does choose who gets to bear it.
Right.
It chooses Will by cutting off two of his fingers, and almost kills him in the process. So maybe the knife only chooses those worthy of bearing the knife, and that evil people can't bear it.
And maybe the universe has some consciousness about it, and that's how this is, and that's how that's able to work. Something that fundamental to existence is in some way governed by existence by choosing who can control that power.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem like pretty consistently through these first two books that any individual adult humans who wield authoritarian type of power have not done a very good job of wielding it.
Yeah.
Whereas the people in positions of power, like Serafina Pacala, has absolute power over the witches, but they still talk things through. There's still kind of like a consensus feel to it.
Yeah, it said it was like a democracy and that everyone could talk, but it wasn't, and that right. She got to make the ultimate decision.
Or who was the Egyptians' leader in the first
book? Oh, Lord Fa, John Fa.
Yeah, he was kind of the same way. Like, he was the guy who made the decisions, but it felt like there was kind of a consensus there.
Or York Bjornsson, however that right. pronounce his name. The King of the Bears, who is only interested in letting bears be bears, essentially.
Right, and the guy he displaced was trying to wield power in a human way, and that was what was so wrong about his regime.
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe the message here isn't really, we need to kill God and displace the church as much as it is. Humans just can't really be trusted with power.
They just don't do a very good job.
It could be the theme, really. I'm starting to talk myself into it.
This book is actually just pro-democracy, yeah. Not anti-religion.
If that's not the theme, which I'm not convinced that it is, but like I said, I'm starting to talk myself into it. The first thing that actually came to mind when we were talking about it earlier was choice.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it kind of, some of the fantasy tropes that exist in epic fantasy stories exist in this. Usually the protagonist has some amount of fate or destiny about them, and
Lyra definitely does,
but it feels less like she is being tugged in directions that she doesn't want to go because of that, and more like she can only proceed to the next stage of this destiny when she chooses to each mm-hmm. time. And kind of the same thing with Will. Like, he kind of has to decide that he's going to accept his role a couple of different times in this book.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, Lyra has the alethiometer, and she can listen to it or not, or she can read it or not, or she can do it to, she says she thinks if she was just using it to spy on people that it would stop working, because she started sensing its moods.
Right.
But, like, she could use the alethiometer for good or bad, and Will could use the knife in multiple different ways, but they each make choices towards different paths, and people get to choose which side of the battle they're going to be on, and one of the reasons to argue against the church is that it's trying to take away your choice by forcing you to either follow the way they tell you to live, or by, you know, cutting away your genitals and taking away your choice to follow that adulthood, or
cutting away your demon and literally removing your free will.
Yeah, just making you drone, basically.
Right.
So, choice seems to be a very strong theme. And I will say, since I did not harp on feminism at all in this book, since I think it does a good job of balancing the genders and making a bunch of different people important and competent or incompetent. But that's kind of the current keyword that I've heard lately for feminism is choice. Because it's not like about give women more stuff. It's like, well, just give everyone the choice to do what they want to do. and then we'll all be equal because everyone can do what they want and nothing is going to be dictated for them.
Right.
So, I don't know, maybe that's a feminist theme in this book. Maybe Philip Pullman's a little feminist.
Maybe. Or maybe just progressive in a certain sort of way. Or maybe he's just one of those cranky, independent individualists who wants everybody to be allowed to make their own choices, damn it.
Yeah, I actually don't really know anything about Philip Pullman.
Yeah, I know that he is... I know, really, by hearsay more than by actually reading what he has to say about it, but he's an outspoken atheist, is what everyone says.
Which is why they hate his book so much.
Which is why the Golden Compass movie had people protesting outside of it. And past that, I don't really know. You know, I've read some thought from intellectual types in the atheist movement, but I have not read Philip Pullman, so I don't know what specifically he says.
I don't either. I've only read these three books that he's written.
So it is you do kind of wonder. Certainly, the themes of this book fit some of the ideas from that movement. Not just the silly surface stuff like, oh, he has a character who wants to kill God. Well, who cares? That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it doesn't mean he wants to kill God.
But that everyone has agency and that choice is such an important part of this, and that he's, to some degree, subverting fantasy tropes by not letting the destiny fate thing control everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is kind of interesting to me.
The other big theme that I put down is the importance of compassion, because Will and Lyra both, you know, Lyra is just kind of naturally compassionate, despite her fieriness and right. capability to lie. I mean, she just, like we said, easily makes friends, easily likes people, and that's, like, a really big point in her favor. And then Will, I mean, not that he's a bad person, but, you know, he's really serious, kind of suspicious, doesn't really have any friends, and kind of one of his, like, really redeeming qualities is that he just loves his mother unconditionally and, like, would do anything to take care of her.
Oh, yeah, like, he could totally resent her, considering...
Yeah, or want to get away from her, but... So, this idea of, like, and then he and Lyra become friends throughout the course of the book, and so this idea of, like, making friends and loving your family and having compassion for others seems to be a quality that the good characters have. Like Lee Scoresby, for instance,
who right.
dies for Lyra, essentially.
A couple of points of interest. Some moments, basically scenes that we enjoyed.
Yeah.
There is... Well, I enjoyed one with Ruta Scotti, who's another witch queen.
Yes.
And...
Proud and beautiful.
Yes. And her encounter with some angels where she was basically ordering them around, and it was pointed out that she's as young and insignificant compared to them as mere humans are to a witch queen, and
yeah.
that the angel's reaction was more or less, well, we're going that way anyway, so let's just agree.
Yeah. Like, she feels so proud of herself to be ordered it being able to order angels around, and then it essentially says the angels are just like,
right.
Okay, whatever.
You make him feel good about himself. Make her feel good about herself, rather.
Yeah, there's like, you know, to them, she seemed just ridiculously young. And the same thing, like when a 400-year-old witch is talking to a 12-year-old, same deal. I just liked the scene, also with Ruta Scotti. She comes back and finds the witches after she finds Lord Asriel, and she's talking about meeting with him and her discussion with him. And she says that she got into his bedchamber and then made herself known to him, and then says she skipped the next part because all the witches knew what happened next, and the children never would have dreamed of it. Basically, Philip Pullman throwing in, like, a, yeah, they totally had sex line in there.
Yeah.
There's, like a sentence or two that just kind of throws away, like, yeah, she'd have to explain the next part, the witches knew what happened between them.
Yeah, and there was a little bit of that, though. It was less about sex and more about love when John Perry was basically the moment he and Will realized that they were father and son. And so this witch shoots him dead and says, I had to do it because I loved him, and now I hate him because I love him. And then she killed herself, and Will's reaction to the whole thing was, I will never understand what the fuck that was about.
Yeah. Will's like, what? What?
Not equipped to understand any of those feelings.
That was very perceptive of that witch, though, to be like, by the way, if I find that guy, I'm going to kill him because he rejected me and that really pissed me off. And then, of course, the irony of this book, like we were saying, you know, Lee's like, oh, make sure she's under the protection of the knife. And John Perry's like, okay. And she already is under the protection of the knife. And, like, Serafina's like, well, I better take you with me so you don't run into this guy and accidentally kill him. And then she totally runs into that guy and kills him.
Right.
Because if she hadn't gone with Serafina, never would have happened.
Would have been fine.
So, yeah, a lot of that sort of stuff going on.
When you meet Sir Charles / Lord, I was trying to look up his name just a minute ago.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
I can't remember what his name was in Lyra's universe, but he totally seems like a big old pedophile.
Oh my god, he gets off the creepiest vibes.
It's like, oh, it's an older man who's closely watching a young girl, and he is dressed kind of foppishly and smells heavily of perfume. He's like a caricature of a pedophile.
Yeah, and he goes up to her, and he's like, really interested, and then he's like, If I can ever, like, take you anywhere or do anything, and gives her his card, and you're like, oh my god, that guy is a biggest pedophile.
Step into my car, don't do it!
But it turns out he's not, thank god.
No, he's bad, but he's not that flavor of bad.
Yeah, he knows who Lyra is and is after her alethiometer and wants to capture her for Mrs. Coulter. Mrs. Coulter, who he is actually interested in.
Right.
And not her daughter. So it turns out to not be that flavor of creep, yeah. But that first scene is like, holy
shit. Yeah, I was getting a terrible vibe off of it.
Oh, it made me really uncomfortable.
Yes.
And the other one is Lee Scoresby's death scene, or his death chapter, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is just really beautifully written.
Yeah, it was really good.
And also hardcore in that he manages to take down 25 guys with a single pistol before he gets killed himself.
Yep.
Pretty impressive. Also, his demon Hester is, like, the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
She's awesome. I love Hester.
Which should be. She's a part of him, and he's awesome.
Yeah, true.
Strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
Yeah.
Strengths, tons of shit happens in this book in a organized way.
Yeah, in a short amount of time.
It's not chaos like sometimes happens when someone's trying to cram stuff in. There are some moments like Lee Scoresby's death chapter that are really well written. That tug at you emotionally a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things I like about this book is it's not just about world building, which is really good in this book, as well as we talked about how much we liked it in the first book. But you actually care about the characters as well. So that really helps, because it's not just like characters running around in an interesting universe. It's like, oh, people I care about running around in an interesting universe. So that's a really big strength of the book.
Yeah, and even some of the universe building that, or some of it is shown in ways that make it feel like it's part of a world, or that make you feel some impact to it. Like when the specters attack that caravan,
uh-huh.
And the two adults on horseback just shoot off into the distance immediately without hanging around, and the witches are so shocked by that, and then you learn that that's a rule Yeah, it's a law that they have, because otherwise who's going to take care of the children when the specters get bored and leave?
Yeah.
And that was the most creepifying part of that to me.
Yeah, the specters are creepy and have basically decimated the world.
Yeah. And then, I guess as far as, like, weaknesses of the writing go, to me, things that you might point out as potential weakness have more to do with people's personal biases than things that I actually think are problems.
Yeah, I was kind of trying to come up with some stuff that people might not like, because in general, I don't have a problem with any of the writing. But I was thinking, if you're one of those people who really likes the familiar and how book one followed Lyra around and book two follows at least four different characters around, you could not, excuse me, you could not like that the focus has been taken off of Lyra and now is following more characters around. I think, and I don't know, this is just pure speculation on my part, but when I read it, it felt to me like the way the witches interact and talk is just written a little more, I don't know, with more of an eye to what he's writing. So, like, the other parts of the book, I never even noticed the writing, and then when I hit the scenes with the witches, I always noticed the writing and how they talked to each other in this, like, really formal, specific way. And it didn't bother me, but I thought it was interesting because that was the first time I've ever noticed that. And I thought, well, maybe some people think some of it feels stilted because of the way the witches are written. That was a guess on my part. I don't really know.
Yeah, I am a little skeptical that anyone without an English degree or two would even notice something like that to begin with.
Yeah, I have no idea.
This feels like one of those where the complaints I've heard about it are from people who haven't read it. just because of the religion thing. And that's not really a strength or weakness of the writing as much as it is just a content issue for some people, mm-hmm. I think. At any rate, it did, as the second installment of a series, it did leave us with a few questions.
Yes.
Such as, brain.
Such as,
burp, who's good and who's bad?
Is there even a good or a bad that we should take sides?
Right. What's the deal with dust? We know it's conscious, but, oh, and we have some inkling that it showed up around humans and human artifacts around the time we became actually intelligent.
Modern humans, yeah.
But is that a chicken and egg sort of situation, or what's the deal there?
Yeah, what is that about? Also, something that I would have wanted to know is, like, a 13-year-old fangirl would be, does Will get a demon?
Do I get a demon?
Well, yeah, I mean, that'd be amazing.
Right. I need to visit Lyra's universe.
Yeah, then you get one. But yeah, will get one? Because they have a discussion about how there are worlds where the people's demons are obviously inside of them, because, they're, you know, they're fine, but you don't see a demon with them, so they pop out. What's the deal there?
Yeah. Our verdict.
Yeah, I really like this book. I'm trying to decide if I like it better than the first one, or if it's different enough that I can't really compare the two. They're kind of awesome on different levels. But I think all the new stuff that's added really works. So I think it's a good sequel.
Yeah, I agree. I really like it. It's interesting things were added to the universe without them feeling like they were bolted on. It's a sequel that actually explores the world farther and doesn't just do the same thing as the first one, but only more so, which is what a lot of sequels do.
That's true.
And yeah, I like our couple of new characters. I like the moral ambiguity a lot.
Of course.
I usually do. I'm not a black and white type of guy. So yeah, I'm looking forward to reading the third book.
Yeah.
Again, I should say. But I'm still looking forward to it. So I will be doing that shortly, but currently I am reading Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Yeah, spoiler alert, that's what we're reading for next time.
Yeah, so for my own reading, I guess I'm just reading the next podcast book right now. Yeah. I mean, get a little ahead of schedule on it, that's probably a good thing.
I think my puppy just woke up.
Good thing we're wrapping up, he may need to go out soon.
I am actually reading The Amber Spyglass by Philip Pullman, which is the third book in this trilogy. So, I couldn't wait. I decided that was the next book I wanted to pick up.
Well, I think that's a good call. So, if you have any questions or comments, then feel free to leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can send us an email, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
We're on Twitter @novelideaspod.
And you can find us on iTunes.
Yeah, and if you do that, rate, review, all that good stuff. So next week, we are going to be doing Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Yes. It's a science, I think it's technically a science fiction, maybe a speculative fiction type thing.
I would say it definitely is, but it also doesn't hit the points of that genre that make you go, holy crap, this is science fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a book I have seen kind of recommended around on the internet and have been interested in reading for a while, so.
Yeah, and there was a movie a few years ago that...
Mm-hmm. I never saw, but...
Got, I would say, slightly above average reviews, but not much more than that. So, I don't know. I guess that's the main reason people probably heard that title, at least.
Yeah.
So, that should do it, though.
I think so.
All right, then we will see you next time.
Bye!